So Leonard, let's talk about the Chopin we just heard, Garrick Olson. You've had a long history with him. Rehearsal today was apparently seamless.
As is usual, Garrick and I are one of those rare combinations that we never have to talk to each other about music. We greet each other, how you doing, how have you been, where were you last week? Okay, let's go on stage. No matter what the repertoire is, we have just this musical synchronicity. I think the first piece we ever played together was the Chopin one, probably in Aspen back in the 60s. But since then, he and I have played so much repertoire. He's, to some degree, I would say, the American pianist who has really grown the most. And I don't mean physical size. He's a big guy. But he's just opened up musically, whether you're playing Brahms or Rachmaninoff, whatever it is, Beethoven. It's just always a pleasure. And musicians love working with him. Elegant when he needs to be, powerful when he needs to be. So I was thrilled when I found out he was going to be the soloist here and we would return to our roots with Chopin.
Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 2, a piece you have performed many, many times with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra.
It was one of our calling card pieces. That and Prokofiev 5, I think, were the two that we toured with extensively. Also, Copland 3, I think, falls roughly in there. But Rachmaninoff 2 was on the very first subscription program I led here and appeared several times, many in conjunction with touring programs that we would do, whether it was here in Missouri or around the States or even in Europe. And we became quite associated with it because at the time, we were in a different state in this country when music directors were leaning much more towards Austro-Germanic repertoire. Brahms, Beethoven, Schubert, Mahler, Strauss, Bruckner. And the Russian repertoire, which was in evidence when I was young, via Ormandy, Stokowski, Reiner, whoever it happened to be, was moving a little bit away from the scenes. So we brought it back and became sort of, not specialists exactly, but we focused a lot of energy on Russian and American repertoire. And those became signatures for the orchestra. It was a time when the orchestra was achieving stability economically. We were being recognized nationally and internationally. It was an astounding time. And it's really nice to return to this piece with all these fresh faces in front of me, ones who played it with me all these years. They're smiling because we're all remembering the countless stories that came out of various Rachmaninoff performances and recordings. And they're trying to pass along the sense, perhaps, of traditions that we had with this piece.
I heard you do it in September of 1987. I was in the seats. And then, of course, your version is what has been planted in my head all of these years, which is the case with a lot of repertoire. And then at Carnegie Hall, I was working as an intern there. You took it twice to Carnegie Hall.
We did.
I was there in 96. So it's a piece, obviously, that you have a long history with.
It is. And in fact, the history is made even more interesting by the fact that my great-granduncle, a man named Modest Altshuler, gave the American premiere of this piece. He was a conductor and a cellist. So the family history with the composer and this piece, as well as others by Rachmaninoff, does go back an awful long way.
I want to talk for a second about your new book. Huh? It's your second book. This one is called Leading Tones, Reflections on Music, Musicians, and the Music Industry. I have learned a lot about our orchestra, plus some great stories from you. It's filled with a lot of fun facts.
It is. It's a book stylistically, or structurally, shall we say, similar to the first book, Conducting Business, in that there are three different sections. This time, though, each of the sections is quite different. I decided to take a look at my own career through my work primarily as music directors with the five different orchestras that I've led, and then some side ventures with others, the repertoire we chose, decisions I made that worked, decisions I made that didn't work. So that became important. There's something I'd left out of the first book. I couldn't at the time because I was just in my early phase with Lyon. So I write about the French experience, other things like that. And then there's a section devoted to six artists, musicians mostly, who I knew and loved and adored, and I just decided to write little profile pieces of them. But the main thrust of the book is mostly about issues that are confronting our music industry in this early going still in the 21st century. So I deal with some matters that could be considered provocative. I know that in some cases there are a few people that are not happy about some of the things I wrote, but everything is backed up and triple sourced usually. So I have all my facts in place to back it all up. The opinions that I gather from that, that's purely my opinion. Others certainly should have different opinions, whether it's about negotiating new contracts, whether it's about the audition procedure, whether it's about journalists, whether it's about discussing fiscal implications of an artistic organization in time of economic turmoil. Some of the articles, chapters are original. Some are taken from pieces I've written for other publications before. But there are also little bits of humor thrown in. I guess the best compliment I get on this book and the previous one are people feel that it sounds like me talking. And that's the impression I want to give.
I said that today, actually. Yeah. It's definitely your voice. Somebody asked me if you wrote the book. And I said, Leonard definitely wrote the book.
Why do they think that I would need a ghostwriter? I have an editor. Because we all make mistakes, and I needed people to really double-check the factual content. But I've been writing ever since I was in high school, and now it just happens to be turning into more commercial commodity or more public commodity. And I'm continuing to write. I've got on my plate now a third and fourth book. One is a technique book about conducting itself, but it'll be coupled with a video. And the other one, I started again with a little more idea about continuing the dialogue within the cultural world, but I've also started to move a little more into the political fray, but not the way one usually thinks of politics. I'm trying to understand the lack of artistic sensibility that seems to be pervading our own society as we move forward. What happened to the value of the arts in terms of what state, local, and federal governments can do to help? Now, we understand there are crises in the world that are much more critical for many people. But it came up the other day when David Geffen took on the society in New York for not supporting the arts at Lincoln Center. Here's a guy, he was $100 million for what was then projected as a $200 million renovation to the hall. Then, boom, it goes to $500 million. They decide, no, we're not going to do it. And he's ticked off because he's put $100 million into it. I don't blame him. And this is only the start of a dialogue that's going to go on quite a bit in this country now.
It is your final season in Detroit. Big celebration plans?
Not planned by me, which is fine. I tend not to want to know what's going on. It will have been 10 years. In reality, 7, because the first year I could only do 5 weeks, so minimal impact. Second year I had a heart attack, so that was 3 months down the drain. And the third year, well, there wasn't a third year. They were on strike for 6 months. And it was during that time that we began to formulate what we were going to do when the strike was over. That does lead very much into part of the book, because so many other institutions that went through turmoil were so focused on that turmoil that they didn't think about what it was going to be like when it was over. Detroit managed to have plans in place that were implemented literally the day we came back to work. We all worked hard on this during the strike. I was in contact with my musicians, board members, management, others. And so it led to things like the webcasts, to the re-evaluating the price structure for people to come, to playing out in the neighborhoods, and to really getting involved in the regeneration of the city. It's very important to keep in mind that for most people, the downturn was in 2008. But for Michigan, it really began in 2006 when the automobile industry began to fall apart, which then meant that whatever recovery was going to happen would probably be 1 to 2 years ahead of everybody else. So the automobile industry spurred it. The products coming out of Detroit from those companies now are outstanding. People all over the world are buying them, which is great. And that led to further philanthropy, to mention that property became very inexpensive. Our largest number of people coming from other places to Detroit are from Brooklyn. Brooklyn is too expensive now. So especially young people in the arts have come. They buy these properties. They renovate the houses that were burned or torn apart, and they're creating a really vital art scene in Detroit. Now, how long it will go on, we don't know. I will be gone, but I'm very proud that the orchestra was one of the leaders of the revival within the city. We became really part of that. Here in St. Louis, when I was here, yes, the city was really in trouble when I arrived as an assistant in 68. And even though we became something the city could be really proud of, we built their reputation, we worked, and we did all that, I, in all truth, couldn't say that we helped to rebuild the city. We were just part of it. But in Detroit, we really were among the leaders. The civic people took us seriously, and it was a very special time. I can really look back with pride on these 6 years anyway.
You mentioned 1968, 2018, 50 years we're going to be celebrating with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra.
We are. There was another time I got here and they went on strike right away. That was
right.
Really lovely.
That's right.
But not my fault. I had nothing to do with that. But it did give me the opportunity to do some radio interviews, and I became terribly interested in radio as a medium of communication at a time when I was about as shy a person as there was. I had trouble speaking with people, not only as a group, but one-on-one. Realizing that I had to do something about it, I got my own radio show, sitting in a room alone, putting on the headphones, talking to people, playing the music. There is nothing better than the radio. There really isn't.
We're also celebrating your 75th birthday.
That's
coming up.
2 years.
2 years.
Please, that one we don't want to rush.
Well, but it's the same year as the 50th anniversary of the Youth Orchestra, which we will also be celebrating, which you founded.
Yeah, and there'll be no 50-year-olds in the Youth Orchestra, I assume, by that time. That was very special. One can always look back and feel proud of the achievements that you did, but maybe on the very top of the list was the Youth Orchestra. There wasn't one when I arrived in 68. It wasn't here. They tried several times and never worked. Most major cities had vibrant music programs going on for young people where they would gather usually on a Saturday. And that first set of auditions, I think we had 5 or 6 weeks of them, listened to 650 kids, insisted they all have and be part of their music programs in their schools. Three of the schools that had kids didn't have music programs, and we forced those schools to create music programs so their kids could come and be in the orchestra. Really, nothing makes me happier than to have seen how it's grown, how it's actually become much bigger than I could have ever imagined. And that just fills my heart up with joy and pride to see this and know that it's there and that I had something to do with it.
In the book, there's a section, Slackin' on Slackin',
yep,
where you interview yourself, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions that jumped out to me, and you probably won't be surprised, the fact that I lived in St. Louis growing up, 14 of your years as music director, I was here from 79 to 93. Which orchestra do you feel you'll be most identified with you?
Yeah, and that's here. And the reason this chapter is actually not just me interviewing me, but I'm asking myself questions that I don't get asked. And that's why I put it in. It's no criticism of anybody, but they just never, nobody's ever asked me, which was your orchestra? Or were there more of one or two? So this one, possibly because I grew up as a student of music and orchestras for 10 years being in secondary positions, then 2 years later I came back for 17 years, so 27 years here. I knew everybody. I was involved in the community. And I think I helped to make the orchestra an identifiable part of the national and international community. It's no disrespect to anybody either before or after, but the simple fact is some orchestras, most orchestras, usually you think about one person. When you say New York Philharmonic, I don't care who's been the director, but Toscanini, Mahler, but everybody's going to think Bernstein,
right,
automatically.
Of course.
Or when you come to Cleveland, Dohnányi was a great music director. Welschel must have been there for 15, 16 years, but it's still George Sell's orchestra. And here, where David did such a terrific job introducing new repertoire, bringing new perspectives and ideas, I don't think people feel it was as much, or they will feel it was his orchestra outright. It's kind of the place I'm associated. Washington is always Rostropovich. That's going to be forever. I don't care whoever takes that orchestra. He was just too big and bigger than life. Detroit, possibly two people. The early one was a man named Paul Paré. He's well forgotten by a lot of people, but Detroiters will say he was the one in recording and exposure put them up there. But it's hard to discount Neeme Jarve, who really was all over the place with them. My role there was just as a builder or a rebuilder in this case. Certainly the impact I made in the BBC was minimal, so that's hardly my place. Lyon, a lot of people are crediting me with a lot of things, but it's probably going to be thought of as the orchestra of a man named Emmanuel Crevin or Serge Bado, who really helped form the orchestra and make it good. We did a lot of different things that helped us fill the house and bring in young people, things like that. And it was a great relationship. I had a ball there. I get to go back for 4 years as the chef honoraire.
That's the title.
We love that title.
Yes, I love the title.
Chef of anything. And I don't know if you know this. Do you know what the French for baton is?
No.
Baguette.
Really?
Yes. So the chef has a baguette. So not only could I conduct the orchestra, I could be in the kitchen.
We have talked about the fact that you are not retiring.
Mm-mm.
You are still going to do 25 to 30 weeks of guest conducting. What about music director role will you miss or not miss the most?
I won't miss the administration part anymore. It's all very different from the time when I began. The role of the music director is drastically changing in American society. There was a time when we were the arbiters of everything related to the orchestra. We put all the programs together. We selected the guest artists. We handpicked the members of our orchestra. We have turned, for better or worse, into a more democratic form, and it is something I'm not as comfortable with anymore. One of the prides here in St. Louis was that even though we did have committees and I was always sensitive to the needs of the musicians and the board, I could make the decisions and the shaping of the sound of the orchestra and all these kind of things. At the Metropolitan Opera, the music director doesn't even attend the auditions. So the orchestra is totally responsible for its own ensemble. So I kind of don't understand the point of being a music director if you're not allowed that more comprehensive role. So leaving that part is not as difficult as I thought it would be when I first contemplated it. That being said, it's going to take a little bit of adjustment for me not to be in control. But I'm learning already in the first few weeks of the season that just coming and conducting, focusing purely on the music, is a very good thing for me. Getting gradually rid of things that I think I used to do well and being more attuned to details or long-range architecture of a piece of music. It's changed my approach to music once I made this decision. And I think for the better. A lot of people have commented on that to me. They're saying, you know, there's something different in the way you're conducting and different in the approach to the standard repertoire, things like that. I probably will also not do quite as much new music anymore. It's getting harder to absorb and digest. Not because the music is particularly difficult. It's just there comes a point when there's just no room in the brain to keep all that stuff going. As far as where my wife Cindy and I will reside, we haven't really decided anything yet. We still have another year in Detroit. We did give up our apartment in France. Sadly, we loved it there, but there was sort of no point. And a lot will be decided, I suspect, in the next few months as we look at how the schedule is playing out over the next few years. Much has to do with the ability to get around from place to place. But there are other things. I'm used to all my doctors.
Baseball teams.
I wish I didn't have the baseball teams. That's absolutely in there. Hockey teams as well. I don't really care about football. You apparently don't either. Basketball has been kind of fun in Detroit. All these things are adjustments now after having done this for the majority of my life. But there's no question that retirement is just not there. There are too many other things for me to do. I'm making arrangements of some vocal charts that were done by a group called the Singers Unlimited. I'm making not orchestral but small orchestra versions because they're amazing. I have a couple more pieces of music I want to write. I have two more books that are things that I want to put down. The great thing about it for me is there's no deadline. I can just write when I feel like it. It's great. Really, it's really nice. Unfortunately, you have deadlines. I don't.
A lot of deadlines.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I want to ask you one other question. Yesterday morning at the first rehearsal with the orchestra, you talked about the events of the past week and the tragedy in Las Vegas, and you could have heard a pin drop in the hall. What you said really stuck with everyone. Can you talk a little bit about
it? It's nice to say. Usually when I see an orchestra that I know well, it's good morning, everybody. Nice to see you. Hope you had a good summer. Let's start with Rachmaninoff. I look at the faces in the orchestra and realize there's an awful lot of young people here now. And if I remember it correctly, it wasn't just about the last week. It was to say we've undergone such immense tragedy over the past few weeks. So we're talking about man-made tragedy. We're talking about natural disaster and how we cope with it and what our role as musicians are at this point. When I woke up, I guess it was Saturday morning, and well, maybe that's not right. Whenever I woke up and that news of Las Vegas was on.
Monday morning.
I watched for about an hour and a half, just kind of shaking my head and trying to figure it out like everybody else was and not succeeding. I went up to my study and I opened the score to the Eroica Symphony, which I'm doing next week in Detroit. I'm immersing myself in this masterpiece, which survives no matter what happens. It's there. Can't destroy this sonic world that was created. And that brings us to what we do as musicians. Most of the time we're there to entertain. But we're also there to take people out of the world as it exists outside of the hall. We take them to other places. We take them on adventures, on journeys. Not many other professions can do that. And we should be grateful every day for the privilege we have of being musicians and being able to do this for other people. Not that we're going to be able to change views on the world, but the idea that our role as comforters, as celebrants, as almost anything, is sometimes forgotten by those of us who are the ones who present music to our public. And I just wanted to emphasize to the orchestra that there has to always be a joy, and we always have to remember why we got into this profession in the first place. Too often we take it for granted, and too often we forget. But when you have horrible events that take place, we're not talking about politics here, we're just talking about the events themselves. We are part of that small group of people that can lend assistance in a spiritual, not talking religious, but in a spiritual way and in a comforting way for so many people out there. And I just wanted the orchestra to know that. I appreciate that a few of you were standing around. I hadn't planned on doing it. I just looked at the faces and I said, they need something. So that's what I did.
Thank you for that. It was very powerful. And I know it resonated with everyone on the stage. And I want to thank you again for being here.
And thank you for being here.
It's always an honor to have
you. You came a long way from L.A.
That's true. Starting here, full circle. But congratulations on the new book.
Thanks.
I encourage everyone to read it.